welcome to North Coast Church. Today, Pastor Chris Brown is bringing the teaching to you, so open up your Bibles and listen in.
It is a lone, shadowy figure that moves through the barren marketplace in the dead of night. With what little moon is out, you see him slip into the shadows and disappear. The city is silent. As we move down through the cobblestone, across the large stone open ways and marketplace, out through the city gate into the countryside, we come across the rows and rows of the balsam grove to a large rock wall and the wooden gate. Effortlessly, the camera takes us up and over into the manicured rose gardens. The little water fountain sits quiet in the dead of night. It sits powered by wind and gravity. Now the water just pools. A moonlight reflects off of it. As we move through the little walkways, you see the large terraces of the mansion as it opens in front of us. And there he is on the second balcony, hands gripping the marble, sweat still dripping from his brow. He's had a dream. He's had that dream. He's tried to run from it. He's tried to stay awake in the dead of night and fall asleep only at a last resort. But night after night, it seems to plague him. He'll walk through a cemetery. He'll see people he knows, but he doesn't recognize faces. It's a way the dream plays tricks on you. He'll look into a freshly dug pit, and there he will see himself and all of his possessions. And one by one, those around start throwing shovels of dirt. His eyes are open, he screams, but no one hears, and the dirt continues to fall, and it's somewhere there. He always sits straight up out of bed, sweat dripping from his brow. He'll make his way once again to the balcony. He'll survey all that he's been able to amass. So what's missing? It first came as rumors from friends. A close companion once said, "Why don't you give it a shot? You got nothing to lose." He's always put it off. It was a little beneath him. But on this night, he makes a commitment: to daybreak, I will set out. And he'll find the one. The one that rumor says can actually walk on water, that can calm storms, that can touch the oozing pus and sores of those with leprosy and molecules rearrange themselves. The one that can speak words that grown dock workers, big, burly, chested men who move large wooden ships by hand for a living, leave everything and follow a guy because of those words. So at daybreak, some servants will go with him. They'll take what he needs for a night or two or three if need be, and he'll set out and find him. It was one of my favorite stories growing up. I guess I didn't quite understand it. It just had a different ending than most Jesus stories. Maybe you've heard it before. The rich young ruler finally finds Jesus, tries to get out what's been plaguing him. Out of everything I have and everything I've come up with in life, I'm still falling short of something. I think it's something to do with death. I'm afraid of it. What must I do just to make sure that I'm in? I'm tired of these dreams that keep me up at night. And the words come back, written and read, are somewhat startling. Well, you know the commandments. Be a good person. And he immediately has this reply. I've been doing all those things since I was a kid. I'm a good guy. Only one thing you lack, Jesus said. Go get rid of everything you have. In fact, why don't you give it to the poor? And then come back here. I'll let you follow me. There's a moment there of stare and disbelief. There's a moment there of, do you have any clue who I am and what you're asking? And there's a moment there that the man once realizes, once again, this will fall short. Of course, I'm not doing that. And the Bible simply says he turns and walks away sad. Disciples are blown away. Jesus, you let the rich guy go. We could have had a new building by now. I mean, we live out here. Could have built maybe a roof. We could gather people. And Jesus says, let me tell you, it's going to be incredibly difficult for the rich to get into heaven. They got so much to surrender. And they got so much making it about them. And just so the disciples don't miss the entire point of the show, he sits down with them and he says, I just need to tell you once again. For the third time, he tells them, we're now going to make our way up to Jerusalem. And I want you to know that when I get to that city, someone will betray me. None of them at the time have any clue it's one of the 12. But he just lets them know, I'll be betrayed. I'll be handed over to the chief priest. They're going to mock me. They'll beat me. They'll spit on me. They'll whip me. They'll crucify me. And after 3 days, I'll rise again. And the third time they've heard this now, the crowd moves on. They approach a city called Jericho, some 12 to 15 miles from Jerusalem. This will be the last city Jesus walks into and out of under his own power. Oh, he'll walk into Jerusalem. They'll crucify him there and take him away. This is the last dot on the map. And I want you to see what happens in the midst of this story. I've had to catch you up quickly because we're starting in Luke chapter 18 and we're starting at verse 35. I didn't want you to miss the 20 verses beforehand, though. I didn't want you to miss the rich young ruler. I didn't want you to miss the part about Jesus saying, let me tell you what's going to go on in Jerusalem. I didn't want you to miss the weight that he's carrying at this time, the frustration that he must be going through, that people are coming to him wanting to get answers but not willing to put anything in. That guys like the rich young ruler are coming saying, hey, I want you to give me heaven. And Jesus goes, here's what you have to do. And they're like, forget that. And he's like, then go. That he stops and has to tell the guys, you're going to want me to set up a throne. You're going to want me to kick Roman butt. You're going to want me to get rid of all that's oppressing our people. I'm going there to die. And he sees the dismay and the frustration on those that are following. I wanted you to get the stories leading up to this. So in the midst of it, we can somehow see the heart of Jesus in this. Because I think this is going to be an amazing example, if you want to use your note sheet, that we can't afford to miss. So if you got a note sheet, take it out. If you got a Bible, open to Luke 18, verse 35, back of the Bible. Look for the guys' names, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. If you got an app, put your finger on it. Bibles don't come easier than in this day and age. Luke 18, while you're turning there, let me also just say for those of you in Fallbrook, man, hanging out with you a couple weeks ago on your campus, what an amazing campus and what you guys are doing out there in that city. And already the growth of family and friends that are joining you, absolutely amazing. It was so fun to hang out with you. Shout out to Carlsbad, to those of you at Green Oak, San Marcos, Escondido. I had a blast this week. I'm helping with your fundraiser at the golf tournament. I didn't help. I just lost a bunch of balls. I was comic routine. But it was fun to go out there and golf with you guys. Ramona, congratulations. Not just that last week was your first year anniversary. I mean, that is absolutely amazing that it's been a year already, and so proud of you. But I just also want to say well done in showing the proper use of communication cards and how to use those things. That was great. I want to point out to Ramona, this is not a new haircut. The glasses I'm going to be wearing are not new. Thanks for joining us. No one else and any of the campuses got that. But Ramona, you know what I'm talking about. That was hilarious. Come up and ask me afterwards. I'm not going to tell you. Luke chapter 18. Are we there? Well, as long as we're doing this, let me just shout also to the group of people that are meeting at the Chapel's House in Rockledge, Florida, outside of Cocoa Beach. And you've been doing that for months and months, that little home church. Love you guys. So great to talk on the phone a couple weeks ago with some of you. For the house churches that are meeting in Brownsville, Texas. So glad you guys are following us, that this is helping you guys. And you're doing your homework right after this on a potluck. That's absolutely amazing. Kailua, love what's happening out there in the house church. Anybody else that's meeting and all the men and women that are serving us and others so courageously and have to do that far from home in this time of year. Thanks for tuning in today, for downloading this. Woo! It's going to take 10 minutes just to get through our highs at North Coast. Get through our highs. That's funny. Luke 18, verse 35. Three of you thought it. I just said it out loud. Now, as Jesus approached Jericho, a blind man was sitting by the roadside begging. And when he heard the crowd going by, he asked what was happening. And they told him, it's Jesus of Nazareth. The guy's passing by. So he called out, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. And those who led the way rebuked him and told him to be quiet. But he shouted all the more, son of David, have mercy on me. And this is the entrance into Jericho. And the man screams out and Jesus doesn't stop. Because we understand what's going on in his life at this time. He is 12 to 15 miles away, depending on where you want to put the front of the city and the blast gate from Jerusalem. He is 12 to 15 miles away from a cross, from a beating, from a crucifixion, from a rejection, from hands being tied in front of him around a post and flesh being ripped off his back and around his side to expose rib cage. He is 12 to 15 miles away from being so bludgeoned that he's not recognizable anymore as to who he is. He is 12 to 15 miles away from a crown of thorns mockingly and jokingly being crammed down on his skull. He is 12 to 15 miles away from dying one of the most excruciating deaths a human can die. If there was ever a time in history where someone needed some time to themselves, if there was ever a time in history where someone had the right to go, look, not today. If there was ever a time in history for someone to go, look, I know what's happened in the last 3 years, and people come to me and they have needs and they have stuff. You don't understand what I'm going through. Some of these people do. I've told them 3 times what I'm going to do in Jerusalem. If there was ever a time in history where you just say, guys, can you take the crowd on this one? Go in and get supplies, get provisions. I'll meet you at the backside of the city. We're going to stay outside of town on this one. If there was ever a time in history where someone felt like their schedule and demands on them had the weight of the world on their shoulders, literally, it was this. There's always going to be another blind guy. There's always going to be people by a gate. There's always going to be someone at a freeway on-ramp with a cardboard sign. And I don't care who you help, there's going to be another one. And I don't care who you help, there's going to be another one. And I don't care who you help, there's going to be another one. And there's going to be another one. If your city has 2 needy people, by all means, fix them. But you can't fix all the needs, can you? And as Jesus was passing by, as the crowd told the man it was Jesus passing by, he doesn't take no for the answer. He screams even louder. All he wants is mercy. All he's asking for is mercy. To get what you couldn't possibly deserve or come up with on your own. And Jesus stopped. Circle, highlight, underline. What stops Jesus from going to the cross? This guy. A place to show mercy. This is where the disciples have got to take over and go, look, Jesus, I know what you're going to do here, and it's going to cause a commotion scene. We're going to be sucked in this. You just told us what's happening again in Jerusalem. Let's just get through the crowd today. Let's just get through the city. Jesus stopped. And he ordered the man to be brought to him. And when he came near, Jesus asked him, what do you want me to do for you? I've said it many times before, but anytime you come to a really stupid Jesus, you should stop. They're all throughout the Bible. Anytime Jesus says an incredibly ridiculous statement, you may want to stop. The Son of God probably has a purpose. Can you see the scene? Blind man laying there by the city gates. It's where he would hang out. Oh, there'd be other beggars. There'd be others of those trying to catch businessmen coming back in who have made a profit. Women who have gone out and sold or trade to come back. Something they can throw their way. Now, a blind man is at a huge disadvantage from other beggars. Other beggars can run up to the camels as they come through, to the stagecoaches as their stagecoach. We just went 1784. And then Wells Fargo and the Pony Express. Other beggars can get there. Shut up. So sometimes it just goes. I don't know. It's better than an airplane. Blind men can't. They sit. Now, Jericho is a wealthy city. Jericho is still in the desert region, but it's still collecting water that comes from the upper hills, from the Jerusalem area and on down. It is a place, as we know, that has incredible palms, incredible dates. Some of you are still making fun of Wells Fargo. Come on, this is church. Knock it off. Jericho is a place that Rome would exploit because of their rose gardens in Jericho, because of the huge palm trees and the date farms that are happening, because of the balsam groves that are known for Jericho. Oh, Jericho is a place that has a lot of wealth. And those are the type of gates the poor want to sit by. A blind man would simply take an outer covering, a lighter cloak, and he would sit in the dirt. and he would wrap it around the inside of the collar and the other, and he would throw his arms under it, and he would wrap the far corners, and he would spread it out almost like a web, if you would, a spider's web. He can't run into traffic. He can't see who's coming. He will find a spot by the gate, and he will sit there, and he will wait to collect. Oh, it's a ruthless bunch by the city gates. Anything thrown his way will quickly be taken by those that have sight. So he's learned his trade. As soon as he hears or feels anything that touches, he will wrap both arms around and scoop one through. And he sat there. And on this day, as the crowd has gotten larger, it has gotten into his web. It is pushing him off to the side. He wants to know why there's such a large crush around him, a commotion going on. And when they tell him it's Jesus, he's not taking no for an answer. And he screams out even louder, "I just want mercy." And when Jesus stops and says, "Bring him here. Cheer up, on your feet, he's calling you." They bring him to Jesus, and he simply says, "What do you want me to do for you?" I wonder if the crowd just smirked a little bit. Everyone can see he's blind. Those that were telling him to shut up, now, hey, cheer up, on your feet. They're going to help him because the crowd has to flit. Now they get to get to Jesus. And they stand there with the blind man, and Jesus goes, what could you possibly want? Maybe the blind man's thinking for the first time he realizes Jesus is blind. This is amazing. What do you mean? What do you want me to do? Lord, I want to see. I wonder how many times we don't have simply because we just don't ask. Well, can't God see what's going on? Well, doesn't God know what's going on? Well, can't God see what's happening in my life and my marriage and my singleness? Well, can't God see what's going on with our finances? Well, I'm sure he can. He's not blind. But Jesus wants relationship, as he's about to demonstrate through this passage. And sometimes relationship starts with the simplest of questions like, "Hey, how are you doing? What is it that you're going through? What do you want? Well, you're God. Don't you know what I'm going through? Don't you know how I'm doing? Can't you see what's going on?" "Yeah, but I'd love to hear it from you." Lord, from calling out Son of David, a messianic title, to screaming even louder, "Have mercy on me." Now he switches to Lord. Somewhere this man by the city gate has picked up enough stories around the storytelling area of Jericho. He's heard the stories. He's heard that there are others that have been blind, crippled, lame, that now see, walk, feel, touch. And now face to face it comes out, not just Messiah, not just Son of David, Lord, your God, I'd like to have my sight. And Jesus said to him, "Receive your sight. It is your faith that has healed you." Now immediately he received his sight and he followed Jesus, praising God. And when all the people saw it, they also praised God. So Jesus entered Jericho and he was passing through. And a man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. And he wanted to see who Jesus was. But being a short man, he could not because of the crowd. So he ran ahead and he climbed a sycamore tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. And when Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and he said to him, "Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today." So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. Now when the crowd sees that a blind man who's been by their gate begging now has sight, a man they've recognized must have day in and day out as one who's never seen before. Whatever type of crowd has gathered to see this Jesus has just multiplied as the shop owners, as the marketplace, as people start screaming and running ahead. Mark will give us the name of this man, Bartimaeus. Blind Bartimaeus now has sight. Bartimaeus can see. And people start pouring out. By the time Jesus now gets in through the walls of Jericho, there is a crowd of humanity and everyone wants to see who the stories have been about the last 3 years. And yet the lens of Scripture picks up on one. Of all the stories we could have been privy to that day, of all the people that were there, the lens of Scripture picks up on one. And all it has to tell us is a title. And every first century listener, watcher, standing there, or a hearer of the story later, would know all they need to know with the title. He was chief tax collector. Dun, 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 dun. You could say a lot about the Roman Empire, but it was ingenious. Had a marvelous way of keeping its control and power in vast regions far from Rome itself. And way across the Mediterranean, on the far eastern seaboard, in a little podunk town called Israel, they not only had their forces and governors, but they had their taxes. And the Roman government worked pretty simple. They would take this entire land, the Jericho region, let's say, the entire Galilee and south, and they would simply ask for taxes. Now Rome's smart enough to know, man, if we go door to door, our guys are going to get jumped or clubbed. It's just going to be bad business. Roman soldiers going to those that they oppress, trying to get money out of them. This is just bad politics. So they invented this tax collection system where they would simply open up the entire case and say, we have the entire area from Jerusalem south, Galilee south, that involves Jericho, down to the Dead Sea. That's going to be an area. Who would like to bid on it? Well, what are we bidding on? Taxes? Who can get the most taxes for us there? Well, I can come up with $75,000. And Rome would say, now listen, you're paying us the money before you collect the taxes. You've got to be wealthy to even get into this racket, or you have to have some incredibly wealthy backers. I got $75,000. All right. Is that the best we can do in this area? $125,000? $250,000? Zacchaeus comes up with $310,000. I'll pay you $310,000 to have the taxes for the entire region of Jericho and surrounding areas. And he's the highest bidder, and he will give Rome $310,000. And that year, Zacchaeus has the full power of the Roman government and soldiers behind him now to go and tax that area. So he has outbid for your taxes. He has put his money up ahead of time. And anything he can collect above 310 is his profit. He is a wealthy and chief tax collector. We don't have that word chief tax collector anywhere else in the Bible or in Roman government. It's either he's got a system now where he's buying up many regions and having people collect for him, or it's the Bible's way of just saying he's made the most out of tax collecting. Either way, can you understand how he's hated? When you see that he is rich, you know he's just an extortioner of your people on behalf of the Roman government. He has outbid others just to take your money and your friends and your family and your neighbors. And you can't do anything about it because the Roman government is behind him. He's a hated man. And it's all got up into one little sentence. He was chief tax collector, but a short man. Or if you sang the songs in Sunday school, a wee little man was he. And as the crowd came, as they saw the blind Bartimaeus looking and jumping and seeing a city for the first time, as it has just taken this welcome parade and magnified it probably some 10 to 20 times its size and frenzy, he's gone ahead of the crowd. He's climbed up into a sycamore tree. And there's something inside this guy, much like the rich young ruler we had previously in this chapter, who has seeming everything. But there's something that drives him for, I'm missing something. Who seemingly has everything. But he can't get his hands on whatever it is that makes you fulfilled. Content. That gives you purpose. And as Jesus passes by the spot, he calls him by name. Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house. And Zacchaeus stood up. Oh, verse 7. Now all the people saw this and began to mutter, "He has gone to be the guest of a sinner." Catch this here. There's a little line in my Bible because there's a passing of time. Jesus said, "I must spend time at your house." The crowd gasped. Zacchaeus comes down and at once welcomes Jesus to his house gladly. All the people saw this and began to mutter, "He has gone." Not "he is going." He has gone to be the guest of a sinner. Do you realize where Jesus went after the parade? Do you know whose house he is at? Can you believe who he's spending time with? Now, there's got to be mixed stories outside. I bet he's killing him slowly, don't you think? You think he's torturing him in there? I don't hear screams. But it seemed as if he knew him. It seems as if he called him by name and he actually knew who he was, what he's done, who he's done it to, and he still wanted to have dinner reservations there. Time has passed. He has gone to be there. And now Zacchaeus stood up, meaning he has been sitting with Jesus during this time. And he said to the Lord, "Look, Lord, here and now, I give half of my possessions to the poor. And if I've cheated anybody out of anything, I'm going to pay back four times the amount." And Jesus told him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because this man too is the son of Abraham. For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost." For this man too is the son of Abraham, not just in Jewish ethnicity, but back in faith with the God of Abraham. I wonder how many times Zacchaeus has heard the Jewish population daily saying, "You're no longer a Jew. You no longer have part with us. You're not part of the promise. Here's your money. Enjoy hell." Slam. And Jesus says, "That's a guy I got to have dinner with." And somewhere in the course of that evening, Zacchaeus stands up, says, "I've heard enough. You're Lord. That's easy to say, but let me tell you what I'm going to do. Anybody I've cheated out of anything, I'm going to pay him back four times the amount." At this, Zacchaeus' wife has got to be pulling him gently back into his seat. "May I remind you how many people you've cheated out of everything? There's not enough hours in the day to pay back everyone you've cheated." He's just dedicated himself to a life of service. Something happened in the heart of Zacchaeus. Something, the same thing that happened in the heart of Bartimaeus. Bartimaeus has changed. He can finally see. And he takes off praising God. And everyone around him also praised God. Bartimaeus doesn't run home to see what family looks like. Bartimaeus doesn't run back to loved ones just to show them what has happened. No, no, he leads worship. He leads the parade in just praising who this God is. That's how he serves. He's got nothing else. He's got nothing else. Zacchaeus immediately realizes, "I got stuff. I'm putting this into service. I'm giving back. I'm blessing people. I used to take from people. Now my job is to serve people. I'm going to pay back. Oh my gosh, this is going to be a lot. This is going to change the economy of Jericho." There's going to be a lot of people buying flat screens this weekend. They're getting some coin they weren't expected. And I've always heard these stories about being in the lowest point or at the highest point needing Jesus. And those are true. But I've never stepped back and watched the context of a rich young ruler and Jesus' statements and 12 miles from Jerusalem and realized there's an example here we can't afford to miss. How busy are you? Just how busy are you? On a scale of 1 to 10, don't say it out loud. Just how busy are you? How much pressure is on you right now? You feel the demands of people? Huh? Any of you have a job that you actually finished on Friday? Well, it'd be nice to have a job that you finished on Friday. Feel like you're carrying a lot on your shoulders right now? You're taking all the kids now as a single parent? Oh, it's on you, isn't it? Oh, it's on you. Oh, you're the sole provider for your family? That's got to feel good. Does it? Or does it just get burdensome at times and you just realize, I can't screw this up? Man, if I screw this up, a lot of people are counting on me. How many mortgages are you responsible for? Is it just your own? That's good. That's weight enough. Others of you realize, man, if this goes down, there's a lot of people that may be losing jobs. Have you ever been there? Have you ever felt like life was just so much about you and you're just so consumed by what you have on your plate? That's what this story is about. It's the Son of God saying, I'm 12 miles away. And just in case you think I might have forgotten, I just told them again what's happening in 12 miles. For the third time, I've told them what's going to happen in Jerusalem. I've just gotten rejected by a rich young ruler. I've told my disciples I'm about to be rejected by my own people, by the own religion I came to fulfill. I've just told everyone I'm living a horrible death and I have to do it. As much as I want out of this, there's so many people depending on me. Let me show you what to do when you get to a place in life where life is being consumed by you. You find time to serve. And in this series, Identity Theft, we've lost that. We've lost the importance of it. Not just the benefit for others, but what it does to us. I think we've lost the beauty of serving at times. In your note sheet, I just want to take you back to reclaiming what was lost. I always talk about page 3, and throughout this series, you'll hear me talk about page 3. And if you don't remember me talking about before, it's simply that on page 1 of the Bible, there's an incredible God. There's a big bang that exploded everything that we are and see and do and where we live and the cosmos that we're in. And science agrees with that. And the Bible agrees with that. Where they disagree slightly is page 1 says that big bang was a voice of a creator that spoke creation into being. There's an unmade maker. It wasn't an explosion, a cosmos of life out of an absolute vacuum of nothingness. You're made for a purpose, by a purpose, with a purpose. Page 1. Page 2, you have the most incredible relationship with that creator and an incredible relationship with each other. And you serve him and you will serve others. And it's going to be a beautiful picture. Page 3, we screwed that up. If you were here last week, little Chris, I like that, did such an amazing job talking about the fall of page 3. We've lost what we're created for and to be in the relationship. And we've lost a lot in this series. We're going to unpack how to come back to and regain what was lost. In this one, I just want you to write down, because of page 3, we've become the center of the universe. Because of page 3, we've become the center of the universe. Because of page 3, we make life about us. It was part of the temptation of page 3 we looked at last week, of Satan coming to Eve going, did God really say that? Come on. Do you know if you eat the fruit, you're going to know your own good from evil? You can be like gods. You can choose your own right and wrong. You can choose your own destiny. You can choose your own right and wrong. You don't have to serve a God that says you can do this. Oh, but you can't do this. That's ridiculous. That doesn't hurt you. Choose your own right and wrong. And from page 3 on, we've been doing that. We don't want to serve someone else's plan. We don't want to serve someone else's rules. We have a plan for our life, and I get to choose what's right for me. That was the original sin of page 3. I want to choose my own right and wrong. That makes me king. That makes me God. That makes me the center of the universe. And that's why so much of our self-loathing, a lot of our depression, a lot of the funk that we get, and everything's about us. Who wins mine? How come it's not fair? Because I'm the center of the universe. No, North Coast, let me promise you, you're created for a much bigger orbit than just you. When you're the center of the universe, that's a really small orbit. And we're created for something much bigger than that. But we've lost that as part of page 3. And we've lost that beauty that God had on page 2 saying, oh, you don't understand. When you serve a creator like me, oh, the life and joy and fulfillment, you are made to glorify me. You're never going to find a purpose greater than that. You're never going to find fulfillment greater than that. And by the way, this is how you're made and hardwired. So you try to do anything else, it's not going to fit well. And we've been struggling with it ever since. Because of page 3, servant has become a dirty word. We don't like to think of ourselves as a servant, do we? Because of page 3, servant has become a dirty word. Oh, serving is good. Oh, you guys went out and helped with one of the natural disasters? That's so awesome. That's amazing. Oh, we'd love to send people that serve. You went overseas and you helped with that. Oh, that's so incredible. You're a hero. Man, we love hearing about people that leave to go and serve in amazing ways. But staying home and being a servant? No. I have title. I have position. My wife and I got to go up to Canada back in February to Kelowna, to a national pastors conference in Canada. Never been to Kelowna. Beautiful place. And we're hanging out there. It's a three-day conference. I get to speak five times. It's going to be just, it's like 40 below outside. So they're like, stay inside, because once you go outside, you'll die. And we're like, okay. And you got these pastors coming in from all over Canada, and this is this big hotel and conference center. It's so cool. And the first night we're sitting there, and I'm down at the table right up front by the stage, and no one knows me yet. And so I'm getting excited about my message and what I'm going to do. And I had a jacket on because I don't know. It's like Canadian pastors, they dress up, and they're not dressed up. Everyone wears a coat, so I can't tell. Are you wearing a tie under that? And so I got slacks, I got a shirt, I got a jacket. I don't have a tie because I didn't rent one. But I'm like, just in case they're like dressed up nice, I'm going to have my jacket on. But my jacket's in the back of my chair, so I had my dark slacks and just a button-up shirt on, and they got the heater on, and chubby guy sweating in Canada. I'm like, it didn't know it'd be so warm in Canada, and I need water, but no one's pouring water. They're setting up tables. It's this huge conference center, and way off to the far, there's a table up in the far right that's got all these pitchers of water on it, and I keep looking at these pitchers of water. I'm like, oh, look at that pitcher of water. So I told Amy, I'm going to go get some water. And you know, you're nice to the table. Anyone else want water? Oh, we'd love some. Okay, I'll bring a pitcher back. So I go and I get a pitcher. Now as I start walking, the first table as I walk, guy, excuse me, can we get water? I'm like, yeah, you can get water. So I pour water. The second table, oh yeah. So I got two tables, I got no more water. So I go back and grab another pitcher. As I pass, that side of the room starts realizing, hey, there's finally a water boy. So everyone's like, hey, can we get water? I'm like, sure, you can get two more tables, no more pitcher. So this time I go and I get two pitchers of water. And as I start walking back, people went ahead. You can have water. You can. And in my mind, I know what's going to happen. You think I'm the water boy. When they announce your speaker for this week, I'm going to stand up and you're going to go, oh, he looks just like the water boy. And I'm going to go, yes, see, I'm not the water boy. I'm so much better than that. See, I didn't get that until finally about the sixth pitcher. I avoided all the tables that I had served, walked around the front, came to mine, poured mine, told Amy what happened. They were laughing at me, laughing at that. And I said, man, just wait until everybody finds out I'm not the water boy. And I felt like, you know that little whisper you get sometimes? You're like, shut up, shut up. I feel like this little whisper goes, yeah, because God forbid you ever just serve people. Huh, buddy? You're Chris Brown. I sat there quiet, staring at my empty plate, thinking someone else should speak. Someone else needs to speak to pastors. The whole time I'm thinking, this is great because you're going to find out I'm not the water boy. And why can't you just be the water boy? Well, I wasn't made to be the water boy. Your Christ was. Have you read the book? Oh, you don't understand, man. I got so much on my plate, and I'm important. I got it. Did you see what was on his plate? Did you understand the weight and the responsibility? You want to talk about titles and positions? Did you see his titles? Son of David, Messiah, Lord. What's yours? Conference speaker? Oh, good job, buddy. Can't even do it in your own country, moron. That was kind of funny. Because Canada's so much better, for those of you watching in Canada. Yeah. So I decided to start the conference with that illustration. Said, if you guys want to leave for the rest of the conference, because that's the type of guy that's up here, I get it. But we're just going to plug through and say, so how do we get over that? Because I think it's in all of us. Oh, I don't mind serving, but just don't get me confused as a servant. I don't mind serving, especially in some great stuff. But don't daily think that I'm going to be a servant. You see, because of page 3, serving has to be learned and strategic. It has to be learned. It has to be strategic. It doesn't come natural to most of us. Now, some of you may have a natural gift of serving, and that's amazing. My bet is Christ had something to do with that in your heart. Maybe you're just born that way. That's incredible, but you're weird. The rest of us want to be served. The rest of us want to make sure people know that, no, I'm in the front table. I'm in first class. There should be a little carpet somewhere, a velvet rope. And you get used to that treatment, don't you? I mean, look what I've done with my life. And there's a rich young ruler that came and said, how can I get to heaven? And Jesus goes, can give it all to the poor. And he goes, I can't do that. And go. See, you're not a servant. You don't want to do what the master just told you. I don't know what Jesus was going to do with his wealth or give it back to him. I don't go. He just said, look, are you a servant? Do what I say. I'm not going to do what you say. Well, then you're not a servant. Go. Zacchaeus doesn't even have to be told. Oh, here, right now, I'm giving back four times what I've cheated people. He doesn't give it all away. Jesus doesn't stop and go, four times, Zacchaeus, give it all away. Jesus didn't have a measurement of it. He just wanted to know, do you understand there is a purpose for what you have? And Zacchaeus got that. I love the way that Philippians 2 says this. Therefore, if you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, any comfort from the love of Christ, if there's any common sharing in the Spirit, if there's any tenderness, if there's any compassion in you, then make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and of mind. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourself. Don't look for your own interest, but each of you look to the interest of others. In your relationship with each other, have the same mind of Christ, who, although he was God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but he set it aside, coming to earth to take on the role of a man, to serve. Oh, he had his power, he had his position, he had his Godhead, and he set it aside. Why? He wanted to serve you. He was going to serve you. He goes, that's the God that you follow. That's the Christ that you follow. And from page 3 on, it doesn't come natural to me. I don't know about you. It's something we have to learn. It's something we have to be strategic about. It's something I have to sit down and go, man, this is something I need to do. You see, each of us are uniquely created to do great works. Each of us are uniquely created to do great works. I love the way Ephesians 2, 8 through 10 says it. For it is by grace you have been saved. It is through faith. It's not of yourselves. It's a gift of God. It's not by any of your works, so no one can boast. But we are God's handiwork, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God prepared in advance for us to do. We are God's handiwork. That word there is poema. We are God's poem. We are God's tangible expression of love. Each of us uniquely written, coded in such a way that you've got a purpose. You have a purpose. We've lost that on page 3. We have to come back to this God and find it. We have to come back to the Spirit of God that made us say, so what am I here for? What is my purpose here? And let me give you 3 things that we discover when we serve. Serving is where we discover our purpose. I said it 5 times. Should have written down already. Purpose. And this is key. Because once we know our purpose, then secondly, we know our calling. See, you can have a purpose for today and go, oh my gosh, I had this appointment and this guy came in and I just decided to talk to him and then it turned about church and then Christ and now he's going to come. Man, I felt like that was my purpose for the day. Okay, that's great. But once you start moving in your purpose and add another purpose and another purpose, you find what we call your calling. This is what you are uniquely created to do. This is what you're good at in the kingdom. And my bet is most of it's going to be outside of your vocation. What we want to do to make a living. What we do to get by. It's like, that's great. That's your vocation. But what is your purpose? What is your calling? And let me tell you, in serving, we also discover our Jesus. Let me stretch you on this. You feel like you're out of touch with Jesus or the Spirit of God. We talk about a Spirit of God, the Holy Spirit. And you're like, I don't know. I've never felt the Holy Spirit. I don't know about the Spirit of God. You want to get in touch with Jesus? You want to get in touch with the Spirit of God? Start serving. And let me explain to you 2 reasons why. Number 1, we follow a God who serves. We follow a Christ who came to serve. So you are never going to be closer to Jesus than when you're serving. Let me also warn you about number 1. You will never be further from the Spirit of God than when you're expecting to be served. Because you're anti-spirit. You're anti-Christ.
Did he just call me the anti-Christ?
One of many, yes, I did. There you go. We're anti-Christ in that moment. Wouldn't it make sense that a God who uniquely created us for a purpose and calling, that when we actually move into that purpose, then the spirit that created us now works through us for why he created us? And wouldn't it make sense that if we're living and operating outside of our purpose and calling, that we don't have much feeling or move of the spirit in our life? Because we're outside of what we're created to do and be. When you are serving, you are closer to Christ than you've ever been in your life. That is his example. And when you are expecting to be served, you are further from Christ than where you've ever been in your life. That's what he showed us in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and what the rest of the New Testament picks up on. We follow a serving, suffering Christ, but we want to be served and not go through any suffering, and we wonder why we feel far from Christ. Does it make sense a little? Two of you nod. I'm going to keep going for two of you. Your wealth has a purpose. Your talents have a purpose. Your background has a purpose. Your baggage has a purpose. Your wounds have a purpose. Your gifts have a purpose. Your talents have a purpose. I already said that one. Your personality has a purpose. The personality that private school teachers tried to beat out of me growing up most of my life. Because I wouldn't sit still and I wouldn't play with the other kids and I wouldn't color outside the lines and I wouldn't shut up. It's like, through 12 grades, God's like, leave the kid alone. He's supposed to be the only one in the room talking. It just comes later. And he's going to tell stories all the time and he's not going to do things the way normal people do. And it's got a purpose. Stop putting him in the hall by himself. And no one ever told me that. No one ever said, hey, you know this thing they're trying to beat out of you? It's a gift. Because I'm like, yeah, take it back. It's like, it's a gift. You're a little hyperactive ADD and you can't sit still. It's gonna come out. It's going to play well for you one day. Your past and your wounds have a purpose because someone, it's not their past, it's their present. And you're going to bring your past into their present and say, I've been there. And let me tell you how I got through it. Your wounds have a purpose. Because someone is currently getting carved up and you're going to be able to show them. This is how you're going to find healing. It's not going to come easy. It's going to take time. But I promise you there's life outside of that. Who you are and how you're made and the way you work and what makes you tick has a purpose. And you're going to find that purpose and that calling when you serve because you were created to serve. Page 1 and 2, we are created to glorify God and serve him and serve others. And when you aren't serving, you're far from your purpose and your calling. And we've lost that on page 3. I don't know if you're like me. I want to be served. I don't want to serve. You see, it means the Christian life should never include boredom. Huh. If that is the Christian life, then there is no such thing as boredom in Christianity. I've heard it said that simply, boredom is the epitome of self-centered life. Someone told me it was John Piper. Austin Payne said it, our new 910 pastor, so I'm going to give him credit. Boredom is the epitome of a self-centered life. How can you be bored? If you've tapped into your purpose and your calling to glorify God and to find a place to serve, to find someone's needs to meet, and in meeting needs, you're opening the door for the Holy Spirit to go in you and through you what he created you to do. How can you be bored? Because boredom is the epitome of, well, it's about me and I've got nothing to do. I'm bored. That's because you're the center of your universe and you make a puny God. Stop being the center of your universe and you'll never be bored. It also means in the Christian life, there's never include retirement. That bums some of you. For some of you, that should be encouraging. At this church, we are blessed to have so many military families attend. And yet I've also seen the curse of those of you that get to retire at 40, 41, 42, or 43 years of age. 23 years in the military, that's to be applauded. The problem is you signed up when you were 18. Now you're 41. And no one salutes you anymore. And no one stands at attention when you walk in a room. Your identity was in a position and a rank. Oh, you need a much bigger universe than a rank. A position or a title. We've seen it in men that don't want to leave a company or an office. We've seen it that once you do or sell and you get a few weeks in and you realize there's no red carpet rolled out for me anymore. People aren't doing what I say. Now every time I speak, they're suggestions and they used to be orders. We've lost our Godship. And if we don't know what our calling is, what our purpose is, if our purpose and our calling was our vocation, then you better never ever lose it. But you've already found out it's not fulfilling, is it? But when our purpose and our calling is people, people, we're never bored. If it's people and serving needs, oh, we'll never retire. Thank God I don't have to go to work anymore. Now I can start on my calling. I love talking to the seniors here who know their calling and who tell me about a conversation they had with the guy that came to paint a house. Who tell me about a conversation they had in a grocery store, a conversation they had in a doctor's office. And it ends with a person coming to North Coast. There's someone that knows their calling. They're never bored. They're never done. There's always a need. And they're blind Bartimaeus who've been touched by Jesus. And they're leading a parade. And they can't believe that there's other people following. Oh, my job was a spider web by the city gates. But this. This is my purpose. I've got a picture is worth a thousand words. At this point in my message, I planned on having 20 minutes left. I now have negative one. Lucky for you, here's what we're going to do. I'm punting. I'm gonna come to your house at 6 a.m. every morning this week. And we are simply going to talk about this next picture in John 13. And every day this week, I'm going to take 3 to 5 minutes and I'm going to encourage you. I want you to see this picture and I'm going to challenge you to serve somewhere every day this week. To do it, all you have to do is text daily, just one word, daily, D-A-I-L-Y. Just text it to this number, 51400. Text one little word daily to 51400 and every morning at 6 a.m. I'm going to meet with you and we're going to walk through this picture. Didn't plan it that way, but it works out. Good timing for that. By the way, you got a friend at work that needs Jesus, just grab their phone when they've left their desk. Just text daily to 51400. And every morning they're going to go, what is this? This little story thing going on. It's your calling. Father, thanks for who you are and this story. For showing us at a moment in your life where you had all the permission in the world to say, not today. I have a lot going on. I have a full schedule. You don't understand my title, my position, and my agenda. And on that day, you stop for the blind that sit in the dirt. And you stop for the wealthy that's up in the tree. And you stop for those that were the lowest and those that were the highest because you felt like and you knew that was my job that day. God, we get so consumed about our life from page 3 on. May you teach us this week. May we wake up daily, be in your word, and see how you do this. And may you show us how to apply this so we can find our purpose, our value, what you put us here for, to meet the needs and to reach others, to share how you've allowed us to see. Thanks for that love. Thanks for that example. Now give us your spirit to pull it off this week in Jesus' name. Amen.
So before we close, if you want more information about this teaching or any other teaching, just go online, www.northcoastchurch.com. Or you can come see us at 2405 North Santa Fe Avenue in Vista, California. Check the website for times of services. And now let's get back to some closing thoughts from Pastor Chris.
You know, as you go, I'm kind of glad I was 20 minutes off on this story. Because even just thinking about it now, we're going to spend this week and we're going to look at the very last example Jesus is going to give to his followers and say, I need you to do this one. This is the last thing. This is his famous last words. Most important thing on the plate. He goes, before I go, you got to get this one down. And it's going to be in the area of serving. And I'm going to love to break it down with you guys this week. In the midst of this night, he says, here's my command. I want you guys to love each other as I have loved you. If you ever need a glimpse of how we're supposed to love people, just pick up Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John and start reading Jesus. And ask yourself, who's got the greater title? Who's got the greater position? And who has the more fuller schedule? And who outserves the rest? I want you guys to learn how to love each other as I've loved you. It's not just a benefit to those that need that grace and mercy like Bartimaeus and Zacchaeus. You're going to find your purpose and your calling, and you're going to find the Spirit of God that you will never, ever find if you're expecting to be served. Man, what a story. It's going to be a fun week. Text daily, 51-400. Love to spend breakfast, lunch, or dinner with you. Not all three. Hope you guys come back. We'll pick it up from there next week. Until around, hey, turn around, greet a servant.